Tell me, Muse, of the man of many ways, who was driven far journeys after he had sacked Troy's sacred citadel. Many were they whose cities he saw, whose minds he learned of. Many the pains he suffered in his spirit on the wide sea, struggling for his own life and the homecoming of his companions. Even so, he could not save his companions, hard though he strove to. They were destroyed by their own wild recklessness. This is Dr. Jim Tomkiewicz, and you're listening to the After Dinner Scholar from Wyoming Catholic College. The lines I read are the opening lines of Homer's epic poem, The Odyssey. The story they tell us is about a great hero of the Trojan War, and about his journeys and his trials. Bracing stuff. And here we go. But not yet. After the exciting preview about Odysseus, the first four books of The Odyssey tell the story of Odysseus' son, Telemachus, a young man who Wyoming Catholic College academic dean, Dr. Jason Baxter, describes as adolescent, wimpy, insecure. He's the polar opposite of his heroic dad. Yet it is to Telemachus's story that Dr. Baxter pointed to encourage our students at the recent honors dinner here at Wyoming Catholic College. Dr. Baxter is our guest this week on the After Dinner Scholar. Dr. Baxter, in your lecture, you said that when we approach a text such as the Odyssey, we, quote, keep coming across passages that feel eerily rich and dense. Now, I've heard you talk about other texts as rich and dense. What do you mean by that?
Sometimes you just find yourself reading a text for the story. You find a plot and it goes along and you're able to follow that. But then particularly in older text, in pre-modern text, text written before 1500 in antiquity or the Middle Ages, you come across these descriptions which are much longer, much more carefully wrought, have many more details than any modern reader would have the patience to write. And when you come across something like that, you begin to suspect, precisely because your expectations have been surprised, you begin to expect that our ancestors read and wrote in a very different way and enjoyed these kinds of, they weren't digressions for them to sort of move on to, but rather telegraphing or signaling some sort of completely different approach to a story. And for me, with my students and also as a scholar, I take those occasions as an opportunity to begin to look deeper for something.
Okay, well, tell us about Telemachus. How does his story begin?
Yeah, well, Telemachus is the 18-year-old or so, I guess 20-year-old son of Odysseus. It's nice when reading with freshmen that they're reading about a freshman. his name literally means distant war, and his name sort of summarizes the whole thing. He was born right before his father left to go to Troy. His father was at the battle at Troy for 10 years and then spent the next 10 years wandering. In the meantime, his kingdom back home has sort of crumbled. There's no piety, there's no justice. And Telemachus, we meet him at the very beginning of the story, has sort of grown up in a world without heroes, and probably also a world without piety, in a world without justice. And he's beginning to chafe under these kind of moral conditions or lack of moral conditions of his city. But he barely has a vocabulary to describe what frustrates him. It's a really kind of neat kind of psychological experiment of what would happen if you, say, without religious or moral formation, grew up in a world which lacked it as well, and yet felt a sense of restlessness and hunger. And the first four books of the Odyssey, clearly named after Odysseus, are actually devoted to the son Telemachus. And that's been something that's kind of perplexed scholars for a while. Why Homer begins, say, maybe the first 200 lines of the Odyssey talking about the great hero Odysseus, but then gives the next four books, or, you know, about 2,000 lines of poetry, to describing the youthful adventures of Telemachus, particularly because it doesn't seem that Telemachus actually discovers any new information in his quest to find out news about the whereabouts of his father.
Now, Telemachus is visited by gray-eyed Athena, who convinces him to go on this quest.
That's right, yes. It's a divinely inspired quest in the Homeric epic.
And his first stop is Pylos, the home of King Nestor. What is he looking for and what does he find?
Yeah, Athena comes to him and in the disguise of an old family friend, kind of a wise old family friend. and convinces him that what he needs to do is assemble a crew, get off this sort of backwater of Ithaca, and go out in the world and look for news of his father. And so he goes to a famous old war veteran's house, who's sort of renowned within this Mediterranean world, and ask for news of his father. And after, Nestor's kind of a funny old character who has a tendency to speak for a long time. He's garrulous. And so after a 200-line speech or something, in which Nestor relates many wonders and many stories about himself and goes on many digressions, he says, "I haven't heard any news about your father at all."
So he's stuck. That's it?
It seems like a waste of time. But then, you know, going back to our original comment about these passages which seem richer and denser than you might expect, if you start paying attention to the little details, you can start putting together something really interesting. For example, although Telemachus doesn't gather any sort of new data or new information about his father, he does learn other things. For instance, when he first walks into the palace of Nestor, he's impressed by the orderliness of the community. He's impressed to see them undertaking ancient rituals with great piety and even joy. It's the first time that he's seen an orderly society. And you can see that the horizons of what Telemachus imagined to be possible are beginning to be pushed back.
After Pylos, he heads for Sparta and his uncle, Menelaus. Surely he will know about Odysseus. What does Telemachus take from his visit to Sparta?
Right. Well, he's actually not his uncle. It's something I joked about.
Oh, you joked about that.
In my talk. I called him Uncle Menelaus because he reminds me of this kind of humorous, larger-than-life uncle that we all have in our lives whose stories you're pretty certain at least have 25% falsity mixed in with their truth. But he goes to Menelaus and asks him the same question, "Have you had any news of my father?" And Menelaus gives an even longer speech. It's something like 600 lines long. And it tells him this huge whopper, and you kind of get the impression that, I don't know, at least 15% of it has been exaggerated for larger proportions. And in the end, he only gives one little piece of, I think, kind of outdated news that he had heard that Odysseus, many, many years before, had been stranded on an island. So, I don't know, a piece of news which is probably about 8 years old and nothing new. So again, it seems like Telemachus's ostensible quest to go in and gather data about the whereabouts of his father is a failure. Then you start looking at these details and realize that the palace of Sparta, Menelaus' palace, has a lot to offer in that it's absolutely splendid. Homer uses a lovely simile, saying that it shines with the gleam of the sun and of the moon. And here again, you see how Telemachus' horizons are pushed way back. He encounters men he didn't even know were possible to exist. And so what I conclude is that in searching for practical and factual information about his father, what he discovers is the kind of heroic soul which can exist. And so I say that if Telemachus went out with the question, "Is my father still alive?" he returns with the answer, "If you're asking that kind of question, clearly you don't even have any idea of what kind of man your father is."
You said in your speech also that as Telemachus enters Sparta, he's filled with wonder.
Yes.
Tell us about wonder.
That's a beautiful word. I said in my talk that, you know, just as, you know, according to urban legend, Eskimos have 16 words to describe snow, Homer has as many to describe wonder. But one of his words is thamadzein. It's a beautiful word. It means to wonder, a marvel. But it's a powerful and important word in the Western intellectual tradition, because both Plato and Aristotle pick it up to say that that's where philosophy begins in wonder, in thamadzein. And so here it's really neat to discover a really rich and potent passage describing the gaping, awestruck nature that Telemachus possesses when he steps into this palace.
Now, Telemachus's journey in education is orchestrated by the gray-eyed goddess Athena. What is the role of the gods and of grace in forming character?
That's really interesting. I don't think Homer has any explicit notion of grace. I mean, not like a Christian notion. But it seems to me, at least my contention is that Homer is a philosopher, and the ancient tradition would add theologian, before philosophy existed. In other words, Homer, I think, is doing something like what Plato was trying to do without the advantage of a technical lexicon, without the advantage of a philosophical vocabulary. So it's really quite extraordinary.
How did the encounter with great literature cause you to wonder? And how do you pass that along to your students?
Yeah, I think that's interesting. Just as Homer describes the wonder provoked in Telemachus by means of his visits, we almost kind of through sympathy or empathy at a distance experience what Telemachus experiences. I don't know, I think I think it's really neat. Say, with my students, we read the Iliad before we get to the Odyssey. And the Iliad is this, you know, hard-knuckled, bare, dusty plains of just war. And you don't meet really hardly any women, with the exception of Helen. You don't meet any civilization. You know, you just, in some sense, see the masculine at its most brutal. But you also see the expectations that these men have for success, and what they want is glory, and what they want is fame, and what they want to demonstrate and put on display is strength and prowess. And so with these kinds of expectations in mind, this ancient Homeric war culture, when you come to the Odyssey, you continually are encountered with situations which you expect a Homeric hero would have been almost ashamed to find himself in. Odysseus arrives on islands and has to convince teenage girls to give him assistance. Telemachus has to go and experience the wonder of these palaces. In other words, I think reading the Odyssey with the background of the Iliad gives Homer a chance to surprise us, to show how this heroism is not as predictable and as obvious as it was. It's not just strength or sort of, you know, prowess in battle, but can manifest itself in all these different ways. And Odysseus has to manifest this variegated heroism in all these different ways in his journey home.
Mm-hmm. And the students pick up on that?
The students do pick up on it, yeah. By the time they're done with the Iliad, they're really excited to get to the Odyssey. They've found deep things in the Iliad, and they come in with a sense of expectation to find something equally exciting in the Odyssey, and it happens.
Do you ever wonder both in the sense of, I wonder how, or I wonder why, and in the sense of being filled with awe over a sunset, a newborn, the gospel, the Eucharist? At Wyoming Catholic College, we believe that the great books and the liberal arts are gateways to greater wonder for our students, for our professors who teach them, and for you, our podcast listeners. Thank you for being part of the journey into wonder. May God's grace continue to open your eyes and ours. For Wyoming Catholic College, this is Dr. Jim Tonkowicz.